Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Ralph Millsap, and you're listening to Swamp Box Radio, where we explore science, religion, culture, and the arts. Our guest today is Dr. Larry Berkelhammer. He's a psychotherapist who deals with pain management and chronic diseases. Dr. Berkelhammer, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Is it possible for someone to assess their own mental health?
Their own mental health. I mean, I suppose if someone is very unhappy, they know they're unhappy. If they're very happy, they know they're happy. I mean, I don't think if someone's very unhappy, then that's a sign that they may want to do something about it, such as either seeking psychotherapy or possibly some self-help method.
But you know as well as anyone that there are people in this world that are perfectly happy that most of the society thinks are dysfunctional and don't belong in the mainstream of society. Is a person equipped and have the objectivity necessary to assess their own mental health?
I mean, certainly there are people out there who are, for example, psychopaths, also known as sociopaths. They may be happy, but these are a group of people who have the inability to feel empathy for anyone else. So the prisons around the world are filled with such people. That's an example of someone who could be a happy person, but they're going around causing a lot of harm to others because, unlike a normal person, they are unable to feel bad for anyone. So they end up causing harm to people.
Did I understand you correctly that being a psychopath and a sociopath is the same?
Yeah, it's just two different names for the same condition.
So essentially someone who feels no remorse.
Yeah, someone who feels no remorse. Most of us, we worry about things we may have said to someone, maybe even from years ago, that might have offended the person, whereas a sociopath, this is also someone who's known as someone with antisocial personality disorder. See, these are three names to describe the same thing, and people like that, they don't worry about offending anyone, and they don't worry about hurting anyone. It just doesn't cross their minds.
How many people do you think, what percentage of the American population do you think are in very good mental health?
In very good mental health? Well, I have no idea, actually. I've never seen a percentage published because it's such a subjective thing. It's one of those things where, for most of us, you know, if we wake up every morning feeling depressed, then we know we want to do something about that. Whereas if we wake up every day and we're happy and we go through our day and we're happy, then there's no need to do anything. So I don't really, even though I'm a psychotherapist, I don't go around diagnosing people. I think for me it's more about, are you happy? If you're happy, great. And if you're not, let's see how we can help make you happier.
Don't most people have some kind of dysfunction? You know, it's today we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, and so the issue of racism is at the forefront. You know, and I've studied this issue, and I've come to the conclusion that everyone is a racist. We all have some kind of prejudice, racial and otherwise, but we just learn to deal with it differently. Isn't it true that most people have some kind of mental dysfunction?
I don't know that I would call that mental dysfunction. I think, we all, it's just part of being human that we tend to go around judging people. That's not, going around judging people, whether it's around race or religion or ethnicity or how someone looks, anything like that has nothing to do really with mental health. That has to do more with just the cultural biases that we're fed through propaganda that we're all exposed to all across the planet.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we probably just normalized to it in an age where slavery was very acceptable and people didn't travel much, so most people dealt with and married people from their own ethnicity. And, you know, the world is very different today.
The world is different, and yet in some ways it's very much the same. Throughout history, people have tended to be attracted to people like them. I think a lot of it's based on fear. You know, when we see people who look different from us, we tend to be afraid. And this goes back to the earliest, this predates civilization. You know, when cavemen came across people from another tribe, they were scared, and rightfully so, because they didn't know what to expect. And unfortunately, we carry this out every day in our lives and cause a lot of pain to other people and to ourselves, because when our hearts are closed to other people, we're causing pain to ourselves as well.
You have spent a great deal of time dealing with pain management and chronic illnesses. As a psychotherapist, how did you become interested in this?
The way I became interested is, first of all, I've lived with some chronic illness all my life. And as I got into I'm now 66. When I got into my late 40s, it started to get worse. And I found myself just gravitating towards people with serious medical conditions. And before I knew it, all of my clients had medical conditions. And so I ended up actually turning away other people. They would call me, people would get referred to me, and I'd say, you know, if you don't have a medical condition, I'm going to give you someone else's name, because I now only work exclusively with that population. At this point, as of the last couple of years, I'm now retired, and I just spend my time facilitating groups for the medically ill here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and also just managing my blog and my website.
But you also do some training as well in this area.
Not anymore. I facilitate groups for people around aging and around chronic illness, chronic medical conditions, and I write articles, and I will go around speaking locally and just manage my website.
Can you tell our listeners the gist of your approach to this? What are the key principles for someone facing a chronic illness and dealing with pain? How do they do it?
You know, the big mistake that most people make is if they're in chronic pain, they try to get rid of the pain. And the harder we try to get rid of something, the worse it tends to get. The more we think about something, the more we continue to think about it. So if I'm spending a lot of my time thinking about what I don't want, if I spend a lot of my time thinking about my pain and how this pain is killing me, it makes it worse. If I spend a lot of time thinking about all the things that I can no longer do, or, you know, physical disabilities, or if I end up spending my time feeling sorry for myself because I spend so much time going to doctors, I'm going to make my life worse. I'm going to make myself miserable. So my approach, I definitely did not invent this approach. This approach goes back a long ways. It was most popularized recently by the Secret, you know, the movie and the book, The Secret.
Yes.
If we want to feel good, we need to spend time thinking about what makes us feel good. That way we'll have more of that. The more time we spend thinking about what we don't want, the more we'll have it. There's an expression, if you don't want it, you will have it. So that's basically my approach. My approach is it's not so much positive thinking, because positive thinking can be artificial. It's really more about identifying what matters to me. So when I wake up in the morning, what is it that gets me excited to get on with my day? And then to really focus my attention on the positive, on those things that make me feel alive, and to really, you know, build my life around the things that make me feel most alive.
Yeah, I look through this, the material and your basic approach to this, and it seems that everything that you advise someone to do dealing with a chronic illness or a severe pain is something that would be good for anyone to do. These are just...
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, if we were to all live this way, there would be less chronic illness, just because, you know, people tend to separate the mind and the body, but there are many people over the years who have discovered, you know, scientists who have discovered that there's really no clear dividing line between our philosophy and our physiology. It's, we need to really pay a lot of attention to what's going on in our minds. What are we thinking about all day? Whatever we're spending our time thinking about, that's going to determine our state of health to a certain degree.
And so you believe in a mind-body connection?
The mind-body connection has been proven. Some people carry it a little too far, and they say, you know, if you're thinking correctly, you'll never get sick. Well, the reality is there are many reasons we get sick, and some of it's genetic, which we have very little control over. Some of it's exposure to environmental toxins. Again, if we've already been exposed to terrible environmental toxins, there's very little we can do about it. But we can always influence it to a certain extent. If you take two people who have the same genetic profile, who've been exposed to the identical type and quantity of environmental toxins, but one of those people is very negative about life and the other is very optimistic, the optimist will be healthier. All things being equal, the optimist will be healthier.
Your approach seems to suggest an interest in spirituality. Where does that fit in your treatment of these patients?
I actually never use the word spirituality. If you look all through my website, hundreds of pages on my website, all the articles I've written and everything, and all the YouTube videos I put out, you will never see the word spirituality. It's because that word has been used to mean so many different things that it means nothing anymore, because you could have 10 people using that word and they're all talking about a completely different thing.
Well, there's another issue. They might be talking about different things, but just what is it? You know, we don't know what it is, even though many people, over 90% of the world's population, believes in a higher power, 85% of the American population is Christian, many of whom say that their goal in this life is to become more spiritual. We don't know what that is, and there's no way to measure it. How does someone know when they're spiritual?
I would say people who think they're spiritual, probably they are the people I tend to stay away from. It scares me when people think they are spiritual, because what they're saying is other people aren't. So other people are less than I am. I'm better than other people. I am spiritual. So that's one of the reasons I never use that word. And when someone actually tells me, says I'm very spiritual, I kind of back away. I don't really want to be around someone like that. I want to be around people who are humble. I want to be around people who have humility. They're humble. They have curiosity. Their hearts are open to people. I don't want to be around people who view themselves in some way as better than other people.
There are certainly not universal, but there are many people that embrace that pursuit, that think that they have some kind of moral authority over the rest of the population, that they're here to impose some set of laws or judgment on the rest of the population. When they face it on nothing, you know, someone could say they're spiritual, and you know, the neuroscientists have found the spot in the brain that gives people that feeling, and they can push that button, just like they can make you feel love or any emotion. Someone can make you feel spiritual in the lab. When they've done that, does that mean spirituality is nothing more than a chemical in your head?
Yeah, I mean, all the feelings. You know, feelings are physiological processes. That's all feelings are. The same with thoughts. Thoughts are things. Thoughts are metabolic, physiologic processes going on. So when we think there are good thoughts and bad thoughts and good feelings and bad feelings, it has validity in a certain sense, in that any thought that leads us to feel good, you know, then that's a healthy thought, because feeling good, feeling happy, feeling open-hearted, that's good for our health. You know, I'm happy using words like that, but to say I'm spiritual, that implies I'm somehow better than people who aren't spiritual. And who's judging that anyway?
There is no way to assess it. I know many people be upset with this, because most people, that is their pursuit, that is their desire. But if you follow spirituality to its logical end, it is nothing more than a feeling. And feelings are completely unreliable. That person might have just had gas.
Yeah. I mean, feelings, you know, they can be made. Get an MRI, fMRI, and you can see where feelings are in the brain. But it's just, why make something more of it than what's there?
Well, I think it makes people feel comfortable. And I think that's the primary motivation for religious pursuits. Is people have such a low tolerance for ambiguity, and they see things in this world they can't explain, so they assign meaning. And when there's a religion that's codified and been around a few years, they think with that comes warrant, that it has greater validity because it's been around a long time and a lot of people believe it. But
yes, that's
no
true,
evidence.
And I think that's true with every religion. It doesn't matter what religion you practice. Most people in most religions think their religion is the religion. Otherwise, they'd be practicing something else.
Indeed. You know, I think the discovery of mirror neurons relates very closely to what you're describing today. You know, the idea that there are neurons in your brain that fire when you're engaged in a certain activity. And if you do it regularly, they'll wire harder. But if a person merely thinks about that activity, those same neurons fire.
That's right. It's very, very interesting. Yeah, you can hook up biofeedback equipment, just simple biofeedback equipment, to someone and have them think that they are contracting a certain muscle, and that muscle does contract. Now, it may not be visibly contracting as much as it would if you were lifting a heavy weight, but the biofeedback can prove that just thinking about contracting a muscle does cause some contraction. Thinking about any physiologic process, you can actually affect physiologic change through your thoughts, which is why it's so important that we become mindful of what we're thinking about throughout the day, because if we're thinking thoughts that are making ourselves unhappy or causing pain, I mean, for example, we've all had the experience of thinking of some thought and suddenly getting a headache or a bellyache or a backache. pretty much everyone has had that experience at some point if they're tuned into it. And so thoughts do cause physiologic change. And so it's really important for us to practice awareness so that we can become aware of our state of feeling. What are we feeling, and is that how we want to live our lives?
You know, we went through this period where we all read Norman Vincent Peale and Napoleon Hill that talked about how your attitude and your thoughts were so powerful and they affected your actions. But now we have hard evidence that someone can actually rewire their own brain. If somebody
That's
wakes
right.
up in the morning, if you wake up in the morning and you're feeling bad and you think, oh, I'm going to have a horrible day, I didn't get enough sleep, and all this is wrong, and you just walk in the bathroom and look in the mirror and say, I feel great, it's going to be a great day, even if you don't believe it, it makes a difference.
That's true. You can convince yourself. You can, if you keep practicing over and over saying, life sucks, well, pretty soon it will. Whereas if you look at what's working in your life and focus on that, you'll feel much happier. And every time we reinforce thoughts that make us feel good, it makes it easier to have those thoughts in the future. We lay down neural tracks, neural networks in our brains that make it easier to have more of that. So we need to really be careful. What are we thinking? If we're going through our day criticizing everyone, being self-critical, always looking at what isn't working, we are actually laying down and reinforcing the neural tracks in our brains that make that more likely to continue.
If you could leave only one idea with our listeners today, what would it be?
Well, let's see. I had someone I trained with many years ago in psychophysiological self-regulation and biofeedback training had something he used to say. His name was Dr. Eric Pepper. And I love something he said. It's a wonderful expression that I'd like to leave your audience with, and that is, the limits of our experience and potential are the limits of our beliefs. I'll say that again. The limits of our experience and limits of our potential are the limits of our beliefs. So watch out for what you're believing.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
In other words, if I believe, if I'm filling my head with the belief that the world is a terrible place and that everyone's out to get me and everyone is just out for themselves and people are all horrible, that will affect my experience and my potential. That will affect how I live my life. I'm going to If those are the beliefs in my head, then I'm going to be interacting with people as if they are all people to stay away from. Whereas, if I open my heart to other people and accept that we all are flawed, we all have flaws, and open my heart to them with all their foibles, then my experience is going to be more positive, and I will have greater potential in my life. People will respond to me in much more positive ways, and good things will come my way. Whereas if I respond to people as if they're all out to get me, really negative things are going to happen, and I'm going to create a negative self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think from hearing what you've described here, I think it might make more sense to state it in the opposite, that your beliefs determine your potential.
Yeah, absolutely. Your beliefs determine your potential. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I understand you're working on a book as well.
I am, and I'm just about to send it out to a literary agent who liked what she read, and she's going to represent me and find a publisher. The book is all about my experience of working with clients, and also it's based on many years of doing literature reviews, looking at the evidence, the very things we've been talking about, actually, is what my book is about. But unfortunately, right now, I don't even have a title to give you. It's premature. It'll be mentioned on my website, and most of what I've been writing about on my, if people go to my website, they will see basically what's in the book. It's, the book has the, will have the advantage of it being neatly laid out and in a certain order, but I've been writing about the same material on my website now for the last couple of years that I've had my website.
So you've retired in your early 60s, and you manage your blog, you do some training, you're working on your book. What is next for you?
I'm really enjoying, really what I enjoy most at this stage in my life. I have my own chronic health issues and limited energy, so I don't have any, I'm 66 at this point, I don't have any big dreams anymore. What I most enjoy is working with people with chronic illness and with seniors in particular now as I'm moving towards that. I'm facilitating groups for seniors where I teach them the very things that I'm writing about on my blog and the very things we were talking about today. Unfortunately, it's only local to here in Marin County, California, north of in the northern area of the San Francisco Bay Area, because I can't travel anymore because of health reasons. But that's what I most enjoy doing, is just helping people to teach them how they can get more out of life. I do it all free of charge. I'm just donating my time now to do this.
So you are practicing the secret.
I read the book and I saw the movie and I really resonated with it. That stuff goes back a long ways, and there's a lot of the reason it's been around for so long is there's a lot of truth to it.
How can our listeners find you?
Just go to my website. It's LarryBurkleyhammer.com. That's www.LarryBurkleyhammer.com, and it's spelled BERKELHAMMER. So it's LarryBurkleyhammer.com.
Very good, and I'll post that link on my website as well. Dr. Burkleyhammer, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me as your guest.
Please join me next week on Swamp Fox Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at Ralph Millsap and at swampfoxradio.wordpress.com. And remember, as Swamp Fox, question everything.